I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Anticipation for a new state-of-the-art laboratory in Manhattan, Kansas, will have to endure a while longer. The building designed to defend against bioterrorism has faced major delays and is now 4 years behind schedule. Today, I look at the National Bio and Agro-Defense Facility. We'll discuss cost overruns, what's behind the delays, and possible threats the planned disease research could pose. Then, some experts say attention deficit disorder is overdiagnosed and overtreated. Dr. Wes Crenshaw says that's not the problem. The family psychologist is back with suggestions to get better diagnosis and management and to review the common mistakes made in addressing ADD. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Remember all that hoopla over the National Bio and Agro Defense Facility that was slated for Manhattan, Kansas, overlooking Kansas State University? Yes, the massive set of laboratories is still being built, but it's running behind schedule. The $1.3 billion state-of-the-art complex won't open until 2022 at the earliest. Its price tag, by the way, has ballooned by $800 million past original estimates. The Kansas News Service and Harvest Public Media, based here at KCU, have just taken a close look at this massive project in a series of stories beginning this morning. You can see it at kcur.org. With us now to talk about it are Laura Ziegler. She's a KCUR reporter who co-wrote this story. Laura, nice to have you.
Thanks, Steve.
Brian Grimmett is the other reporter on this project. He's with the Kansas News Service. He joins us now from KMUW down in Wichita. Brian, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Brian, why the big delay in the opening of the National Bio and Agro Defense Facility? I mean, the opening has now been delayed by at least 4 years.
Well, part of the delay came with some of the redesigns that they had to do to make sure that it would be safe enough. They had concerns over, they did an audit back in 2012, and they had concerns over whether or not it would be able to withstand tornadoes and then earthquakes and then just some of these things that are kind of unique to Kansas. And so that led to some redesigns that meant more concrete and more time and ultimately more money.
Is that what led, Laura, to the $800 million cost increase here? Is that what we're talking about?
That's a lot of it. Like Brian said, there were two different environmental impact statements that said that the risk mitigation, just what the design was flawed, basically, mm-hmm. that it wouldn't. Manhattan had just had a, I think, F4 or F5 tornado sweep through it and had leveled a lot of buildings. And that was a big concern. And also, there wasn't anything like this. You know, there's nothing like this in the United States now. The thing closest to it is Plum Island. That was built in 1954. So they really didn't know what they were getting into, and it was probably under-budgeted in the bidding process. Hmm. They probably, K-State and DHS, bid off more than they could chew at the outset, I think it's safe to say.
$800 million, though, Laura, that's a lot of money.
Well, like Brian said, they had to put a lot into it after this environmental impact statement. Then there was a review by the National Academies of Science. And they said in their initial review that there was a 70% chance over the 50-year life of the lab that there could be a break or a release of one of these pathogens. So they went back to the drawing board. And like Brian said, they put in a lot of concrete and steel barriers. They thickened the walls. They really put in a lot of risk mitigation that they were required to do. And the second report said that the risk of a release was less than 1%. Hmm. That was a little bit controversial, that report. Some experts questioned the methodology of it, but it was enough to get the lab started. And a lot of people were comfortable with that. They really did put a lot into making it safer.
Brian, Laura just used this word leakage out of this facility. I think maybe we should give our listeners some context. If there is a leakage of foot and mouth disease, for instance, this could be nothing short of catastrophic in a state like Kansas, right?
Yeah, I mean, it'd be a really big deal. Beck, I mean, just to give kind of an idea of what an outbreak of foot and mouth disease would do if it were to be widespread. Back in 2001, there was an outbreak in the United Kingdom, and it cost them, so it lasted, I think, 6 to 9 months before they were able to kind of really wrap it up. They had to kill millions of cattle, and it cost about $10 to $15 billion is their estimate, and what it cost the economy there in the United Kingdom when this happened just in 2001, not that long ago.
So a leakage like this in a state like Kansas, you might see something similar, Brian? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, cattle outnumber Kansans 2-1, pretty much. And so
good for us. Yeah.
If this were to spread, and again, a lot of what they're trying to study here at InBev is actually, if there were an outbreak, how can we identify it and diagnose it and stop it from spreading quickly? So it's kind of hard to guess how far it would spread, but if it were to spread as quickly as, say, it did in the United Kingdom, if they didn't recognize it fast enough, then yeah, I mean, we're looking at billions of dollars, not just to Kansas's economy, but to the United States economy because of all none of this stays here in Kansas. Everything is transported somewhere else. Hmm.
Laura, has all of this, all of these concerns led to some second guessing about why Kansas was picked to begin with here? Because it always struck me there's something a little counterintuitive about the federal government locating a facility like this in a state where, as Brian just said, cows outnumber humans. If there's a leak from this facility, you know, look out.
That's right. And it depends on who you talk to, whether it's counterintuitive. Of course, the university and the political establishment, local, state, and national, were 100% behind this. I mean, the process started,
They wanted the jobs and the construction and
there was an environmental impact. I mean, an economic impact statement that said it would bring hundreds of jobs, research jobs, high-level research jobs to people who would move to Manhattan and live there and shop there and pay property tax and whatnot. And, of course, the construction has been going on now for several years, and hundreds of people have been hired to do that. So that's definitely a part of it. It's prestige. It's great for Kansas State. They have already a large footprint, as you know, in the animal science and veterinary health industry. And another piece of it is the monetization of the products and the research that happens there. They're looking to attract a lot of pharmaceutical companies that work in animal health.
And this does strengthen the argument that I-70 on both sides of Kansas City is the animal health corridor,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely. That was a flagship argument in favor of putting it in Kansas.
I was going to say, Brian, why was Manhattan, Kansas picked for this project to begin with?
That's an interesting question. It kind of depends on who you ask. On one side, you can say, really, there was a lot of political clout that helped get it here.
With Kathleen Sebelius, and then Brownback picked up the baton and ran with it.
Yeah, and I think he was senator at the time. Senator Brownback doesn't come up as often as some of the other big names, but he did play a big role in getting it here. And I think it was even a surprise in the end that Kansas did end up getting it, because there were some other big names and big states. Texas really wanted this facility, and for it to end up in Kansas was kind of it was a really big victory for the politicians who worked on this at the time.
Kansas ended up filing a lawsuit saying that there was some Mickey Mouse around the
Texas filed the lawsuit.
Texas. Yeah, Texas filed a lawsuit after Kansas was awarded it.
Senator Pat Roberts, Brian, was a key player in this, right? The senator who's retiring in early 2021, I think.
Yeah, he was. And he's also was a big part of kind of this smaller sister facility that's right next to InBev that's not a federal facility. It's actually Kansas State's facility. It's called the Biosecurity Research Institute. They've named it Pat Roberts Hall, basically because he was so influential in creating the BRI, this research institute, and in getting InBev to come to Kansas. And so this smaller facility at Kansas State was kind of this look at what we can do. Let's prove ourselves and how well we'll be able to handle this much larger facility.
How much excitement, Laura, is there in Manhattan over this project coming to the city? It's under construction now. What do you sense from the folks there?
Well, hey, Tiki, coming back to this, but again, it depends on who you ask.
Yeah,
I would say for the most part, in general, there's a lot of excitement about it. It's coming up out of the ground, this huge, massive compound.
If you sit in the football stadium, the Bill Snyder Family Stadium,
right,
you can see this thing pretty
clearly.
Oh,
absolutely. It's huge. 47 acres and you know, high-tech metal, aluminum, and I'd say in general there's a lot of excitement, certainly among the political and economic establishment. There's a lot of excitement. There is still a quiet group of people who don't talk a lot, don't have a loud voice at this point, but are concerned about living in the shadow of this lab that's going to be researching a lot of incredibly contagious diseases to animals and potentially, well, definitely lethal to humans if they should escape, and the remote chance that they should escape, and sort of a lack of a feeling that there's a lack of transparency. I mean, people just don't know as much about it as they would like to. Again, that opposition voice is really pretty quiet at this point. It was always kind of diffuse. It was there from the very beginning. There were people that didn't want it in Kansas, but there was such a juggernaut of support from the university, the state and national political establishment, that they really feel like they never had a chance. And then it got passed and started to be built, and they sort of quieted down. Now, if you go back and talk to some of those people, there's still a little bit of apprehension mm-hmm. about it. But I'd say in general, people are really excited about it.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking this morning about the National Bio and Agro Defense Facility under construction out in Manhattan, Kansas. Still some controversy attached to it. It's being built adjacent to Kansas State University. If you have questions or comments about this facility, we have two great reporters who have done a story, a very good story, that's on the KCUR.org website this morning that takes a close look at this project. Our number 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Brian, tell us a little more about what this facility is going to do. We talk about combating agro-terrorism. What are we talking about here?
So what we're talking about is they will be developing, or at least trying to develop, ways to detect, ways to diagnose, and ways to vaccinate against some of these really deadly animal diseases, such as foot and mouth disease or African swine fever or Rift Valley fever. And so they'll be doing the research into figuring out, like I said, how to vaccinate against these things. And in order to do that, and at least in order to do that on kind of a larger scale, you've got to do it on the animals themselves. And it's not easy to contain, say, even from pigs to sheep to cattle, you know, they have to put them inside the building and make sure that they're in rooms that are disconnected from pretty much the outside world, that the air only flows in one direction, and that's from the outside in. And so that's what makes this facility so unique, is really just its scale. There are laboratories already all over the country that can do some of this work and can deal with some of these viruses, but to do it on this scale and to be able to do it on so many animals at once is really what NBAF is bringing to the table.
And it's designed to ensure that if there is some kind of bioterrorism attack here in the heartland, we have a way to combat it. Brian, does it really come down to that?
Yeah, and it's when you talk to the researchers, the ones who are actually studying these viruses, they're not so much concerned as whether it's introduced purposefully or accidentally. They just want to be able to stop it if it's introduced, period. And so from the research perspective, they're not as interested in what, like I said, whether or not it's terrorism or not. And I think some of those fears, while they are still there and they still exist, they're taking more of a back seat, as this is just a problem in general, and we can't let this spread through just the general commerce of things moving from China to here and vice versa.
You know, you guys, Brian, had an interesting comment from Senator Roberts in this story, talking about how easy it would be to spread a pathogen from Afghanistan. He said you'd put a handkerchief under a diseased cow in Afghanistan, you throw it in a Ziploc baggie and send it over to Kansas somehow and dump it in a feedlot, and away you go. Is it really that easy?
Yeah, I mean, it yes and no. It is high. Some of these diseases depend on what the disease is, but
sure.
Foot and mouth, yeah, it is highly transmissible. It does stay on objects for, I think they say, up to it can survive 2 to 3 weeks on an object. And so, yeah, potentially you could do that. I mean, it's probably a little more complicated than that, but that's not that unrealistic of a scenario.
it's airborne. Foot and mouth disease is airborne. So, and it's tiny microscopic spores. So what Senator Roberts was talking about is if you swiped an animal that on the nose, for example, that had foot and mouth disease, you're pretty much guaranteed that some of those spores would stay alive on a trip overseas. And the other point about the contagibility is how much traffic there is around the globe now. Mm-hmm. People and animals are traveling at a much faster pace around the world. And that has made some of these exotic foreign animal diseases, like Brian mentioned, African swine fever and classical swine fever. African swine fever is already a problem now in other places around the world and threats of it in the United States. Nipah virus and Hendra virus, these things that are really quite exotic to us, most people have never heard of, but extremely zoonotic, which means they can transfer from animals to people really easily. So the concern is people traveling in other parts of the world much more than they used to, commerce happening much more rapidly globally.
Yeah. Let's go to some phone calls at 816-235-2888. Let's go to Carol from Lawrence. Carol, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having this program. It's very important. I found that most people don't even know what NBAF is. 90% of the people don't even know what it is. I grew up in Riley County. It's near and dear to my heart. And I believe that this NBAF is a disaster waiting to happen. It's not if, but when. As you recall, it was originally in Plum Island,
right.
And they didn't want it there. They thought it was too dangerous. So we've moved it to the middle of the country, where if a disaster happens, it spreads to the whole midsection of the country. And
Carol, where could this thing be located that would be a safer choice in your estimation?
Okay, they have talked about other island locations for this. That has been in the reports. And if they have to have this kind of facility, it needs to be in an island location. I mean, Laura Ziegler, I've spoken with her before, and your other reporter, they mentioned that this would bring jobs. Well, okay, who are you going to get that you can trust enough to work with these high-level pathogens? And these workers, I remind you, go to work and then come back into the community.
Right.
This facility is located in a tornado-prone area, and it's also downstream from Tuttle Creek Dam.
Well, let me do this, Carol, and I appreciate your sentiments here. You know, Laura Ziegler, talk a little bit, if you will, just about the safety procedures that will be wrapped around this facility and what the workers will have to go through to even enter and exit each day. It doesn't mitigate all the concern. You've already pointed it out, but there's a whole lot of procedure going on here.
Yeah, there are multi-levels of security that workers have to go through. They shower in, they shower out, they put on basically a hazmat suit before they get in. The air filtration system, as Brian said, just brings air in. It can't go out. They go into several rooms and isolation rooms. They have handbags that they work on the small microscopic things in.
Right.
There's a very sophisticated water treatment and waste treatment facility. But I think it's important to note that the experts have said that even though they have reduced the risk to almost nothing because of the structure there, you can never eliminate the risk of human error.
Yeah.
It's impossible. You know, there's always that risk.
Brian, something else your story points out that I wanted to get to here. This facility, I'm going to botch the lingo here, but it's got a level 4 laboratory, one of the highest.
It is the highest.
Most secure labs that does the most dangerous, potentially lethal work around. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so there are these four levels of security in labs, and they basically go from a scale of 1 to 4. NBAF will have what's known as BSL-4 large animal, and what that means is they will be able to, like I was talking about earlier, be able to handle cattle and sheep and pigs inside of these laboratories. BSL-4, which is the highest, it's biosecurity level 4, that is meant for diseases that are highly contagious, they're airborne, they are zoonotic, so they can pass between humans and animals, and there's not really any known treatment for it. That's kind of the main differences between it and BSL-3. BSL-3 and BSL-4 are really similar, other than how bad the virus is. And, right. and when this facility is completed, it'll just be one of four in the entire world that is BSL-4 large animal certified.
You know, Laura, to go back to our caller's point, you know, was there an island location, a really remote location that was a possibility here? Or given the fact you have lots of jobs and people working there, was that simply unreasonable, I guess?
No, they did consider renovating Plum Island. It was built in 1954, so the research had been going on there. But
this is by New York City.
Yeah, it's off the coast of New York City.
Right.
It's an island off the coast of New York City with beautiful beaches and actually where people live there. But there was always an undercurrent of opposition to it being there because of the people. And there have been releases from Plum Island. There were releases, which people argue were contained because of its island nature. There wasn't, as far as I know, another island that they considered. There were 29 sites that originally were competing for NBAF. Several of them had outright revolutions and said they were absolutely not going to have it. And those sites were taken off the table right away because of the strong opposition. Boston was one. Kentucky had another. But I think that the people that are opposed to it being in Kansas still argue, and many experts argue, that it really should be on an island.
Yeah. To what extent, Brian, and again, you guys talk about this in your story, to what extent is Manhattan, Kansas prepared for an outbreak should that occur?
Well, that's probably a better question for Laura, but I did want to add one thing to the last question, and that is not that this necessarily makes it any safer, but there are already thousands of BSL-3 labs, which is just below BSL-4, with deadly viruses on the mainland being studied right now. The BRI, which already is complete in Manhattan, they study Rift Valley fever and African swine fever, which are really bad and really contagious. So people are doing this every day all around the United States. Whether or not that makes it safe or not is I guess you could still debate that. But it's not so – NBAF is not so unique, as in we don't understand how to contain these things.
It is the only place that will be studying foot and mouth disease. And that, I think, is one of the big arguments, because they actually changed legislation to get foot and mouth disease to be able to be studied on the mainland to – build NBAF.
How prepared is Manhattan for this, Laura?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. you know, there is one main hospital that has 12 isolation rooms, and the preparedness expert showed me around and showed me how the isolation rooms work. It has much of the air filtration systems that NBAF will have, so that doctors and researchers and patients that come in with some kind of contaminated infection will be isolated. They have been doing tabletop and functional exercises with law enforcement and ag officials. But I think there's always that feeling that you never know how to handle it until it happens, and nothing like this has ever happened before. So they're as prepared as they can be, I guess.
Brian, I want to catch just one more point here. NBAF, this laboratory being built in Manhattan, is now going to be under the authority of the Ag Department as opposed to Homeland Security. Why was that change made, and what significance should I take from that?
I don't know much about why it was changed, other than with the U.S. Department of Agriculture already oversees, like I was talking about earlier, a lot of these labs out there. They've got a big lab in Ames, Iowa. They work with some labs in Washington State. It's part of this big network of animal research labs. So they've typically taken the lead on this anyway. And I think as the terrorism aspect, not that that still isn't a possibility, but as that kind of falls to the wayside, I think it just made sense to put it with all of the rest of the labs studying animal diseases under the purview of the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Okay, we're going to leave our conversation there. Again, I want to point out that Laura and Brian's very good story is now, you can see it at kcur.org. Laura Ziegler, a reporter here at KCUR, Brian Grimmett with the Kansas News Service, thank you both for a good conversation and a great story as well, an important story.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, Dr. Wes Crenshaw will join us, and we'll talk about attention deficit disorder, a condition that so many of our kids are struggling with. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday's show, Mindy Corporan joined us years after her father and son were killed in Overland Park by a neo-Nazi. She formed an unlikely bond with a reformed white supremacist. You can hear why at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, I'll look at the damage inflicted on individuals and communities in one of the most violent cities in America. We'll talk with the author of An American Summer, Love and Death in Chicago. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, the diagnosis of attention deficit disorder has been given to 6.4 million kids in this country. That's 11% of the population, ranging in age from 4 to 17 years old. That's gone up about 5% each year since 2003. And that doesn't even account for the far larger population of adults presently in treatment. Many experts claim ADD is overdiagnosed and overtreated, but Dr. Wes Crenshaw says that's not the problem at all. He's back to discuss the most common mistakes that parents and adults make in addressing ADD and how to get a better diagnosis and treatment. With us once again is Dr. Wes Crenshaw, author of I Always Want to Be Where I'm Not, Successful Living with ADD and ADHD. He's also the co-author of the forthcoming book, ADD and Zombies, Fearless Medication Management for ADD and ADHD. Wes, welcome back. Zombies?
Kind of a tongue twister, yeah, there, wasn't it?
Zombies? What are you talking about here?
Okay. So the preview on that is people who take medication for ADD and don't have maybe the kind of relationship with the prescriber we would want will refer to this as the zombie effect, where they just feel, you know, kind of flat and blah. And that's not really how you're supposed to feel. So that's why it's ADD and zombies.
Okay. Well, we've talked about this before, but let's do it again here. What's the difference between ADD and ADHD?
Yeah. Bad branding is what.
Yeah.
So when they.
A lot of confusion.
Well, when they put, I think it was DSM-3R, we're up to DSM-5 now. That's the diagnostic and statistical manual we use to prescribe or to diagnose. Somewhere in there, they changed the diagnosis from attention deficit disorder with or without hyperactivity to attention deficit disorder with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So then there's several subtypes, and one of them is inattentive type. And the reason it's such poor branding is it would be like if you went in and ordered a cheese pizza without the cheese. So people always associate ADHD with hyperactivity, and it's the minority of kids and adults who actually have symptoms of hyperactivity. It's inattention that is the core element of ADD, yet it's called ADHD.
Well, we know our listeners, many parents out there oftentimes have questions about attention deficit disorder. If you want to join our conversation and ask Dr. Wes a question, you can do so. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR. I've been on vacation for a week. At KCUR up to date. Okay. Just about everyone believes ADD is overdiagnosed, but you say that's not only unproven, Wes, it's also unprovable. Help me there.
Right. So, and it's actually, there's a whole bunch of ADD skeptics that exist out there, but this theory that it's overdiagnosed is even prevalent amongst the people who accept the diagnosis. Keith Connors, who is the guy who authored our assessment instruments that we use, is frequently quoted as claiming it's overdiagnosed. And here is the problem with that, and it's actually more than statistical semantics. In order to know something is overdiagnosed, you have to know how many people really have ADD or depression or anxiety or anything else.
And you say we can't know that.
You can't know that. And so when you go around telling people, oh, it's overdiagnosed, that becomes demeaning.
I've heard this too. Is there some thought just to the notion that there's a knee-jerk response when kids say they struggle with attention to automatically give medicine? Is that maybe what they're talking about?
Well, it goes a little farther than just the kid, but what Connors and a number of people are saying is that people are getting diagnosed who shouldn't be. And I agree with that. But there's also people who are not getting diagnosed who should be. We know because, you know, we see them all the time. So the issue isn't overdiagnosis. It's bad diagnosis. Mm-hmm. It's poorly conducted diagnosis.
How difficult is it to diagnose it?
More difficult than a lot of people want you to think. Mm-hmm. We do two things in our clinic. We give the Connors instrument, which is norm referenced. And the thing you got to know about any diagnosis is it's about deviation from the norm. You have to deviate. And so if you just sort of forgetful and, you know, a little bit inattentive, maybe you're just what I call a leaner. Maybe that's just a little bit of your type. But to really get diagnosed, you have to differ from the mean of people in the population a certain amount in order to be diagnosed. And this instrument helps us do that. Plus, we do an extensive clinical interview to rule out a bunch of other stuff like bipolar disorder or sleep deprivation or anxiety, a lot of other things. So it too many people go in to a physician, usually their primary care physician, and spend, you know, 20 minutes in there and they walk out with stimulants. So if there's any over-treatment or over-diagnosis, it's usually in that kind of a situation.
Yeah. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. We're talking about attention deficit disorder with Dr. Wes Crenshaw from Lawrence. Let's go to some calls here. Christopher from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Hi. Thank you. Good topic. I agree with the good doctor. It's not always diagnosed accurately, and meds are given out far too quickly. And really, they shouldn't be given out by primary care people. They should see a specialist like Dr. Crenshaw.
Thank you for that endorsement. We're very busy right now, however.
Okay. He doesn't need the referrals, but I do agree with what you're doing.
Thank you.
I have one statement that's kind of a question statement. I realize we have to treat these disorders. These children who have severe ADD or ADHD, you can tell I date myself by the way I say it, really do have difficulty setting in school, some problems with concentration. Within our current system, they have to be able to pay attention. But, you know, Dr. Crenshaw, it occurred to me years ago that is this really a disorder? Because we evolved on first in the jungles and then the savannas of Africa, and we were all about hunting and gathering constantly and constantly being aware because we were an endangered species up to about 10,000 years ago. So the idea of setting in a closed environment and setting still for 8 hours a day when they've taken out recesses and they've taken out art classes and taken out gym and taken out a lot of sports. Are we treating really what is an artifact of our evolution?
Yeah, that's interesting. It's a very good question, and it's been discussed in the anthropological psychiatry literature. So I will admit to my one reality TV show indulgence, and that is Naked and Afraid. I like that show, and there are a couple of people on there. That's actually several.
That's a Discovery Channel show,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I've seen that before. It teaches you a lot about primitive survival.
Yes.
And so there are a number of the people that are pretty good hunters on there, and they go out and crawl, you know, naked through the African Sahara on their bellies slowly, and they lie in wait, and they wait, and they wait, and they wait, and they're thirsty, and they're hungry. And finally, you know, the animal comes up and they shoot at it and miss. And they go home and it's horrible. I think the problem with the hunter theory is, and the farmer theory, is it takes immense patience to do that. And those are not the ADD people who were out there, you know, running around, excited adventurers. The successful people in primitive survival are the people who can sit for 8-9 hours and have nothing happen. And that's against the diagnosis of ADD.
So why is ADD diagnosis of it going up at 5% a year? What's happening out there? Do we know what the cause is?
So, yeah.
Is it cell phones? What is it?
So the answer is no, we do not. But there are several more valid hypotheses than others. First of all, of course, we're just better at detecting it. During this same period of time, autism diagnosis has gone up at least as much or more percentage-wise than ADD. But you don't have people come in the air and say, oh, you know, autism is fake. It just doesn't exist. Nobody ever says that. So, and it's not any easier to diagnose autism than it is ADD. There are many things that can mimic that. So detecting it better is how we now see autism more and how we now see ADD more and depression and anxiety. Secondly, it is true that people are going in and saying, oh, I can't read a book, so give me stimulants. And physicians are making that happen. So there is a trend towards excess diagnosis and treatment. And then third, if you hadn't noticed, I know you have, the world is just a whole lot harder to keep track of at this point. What was possible in my father's era, to work in a factory or to work in a business where you weren't just constantly on, 24 hours a day, and school was not as advanced. People are studying now in middle school, mm-hmm. what we studied in high school and college. And so the pressure is really on. And so the people who previously would have gotten through just fine without this hyper attention are now struggling. And the people who have good attention, strong attention, maybe deviate even a little in the positive direction on that, they are the ones who can produce better in this society. And the folks who are beneath that mean are struggling and seeking
treatment. So there's more to keep track of out there. So we've sorted ourselves a little bit. And
exactly.
Folks who might have been on the bubble are stepping forward saying, I got a problem.
Perfectly said. Wow, you got that said.
There you go.
It's like you're a professional. you got it said in short order.
That's exactly. The nicest thing you've ever said to me, Wes. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Let's go to Lee from Overland Park. Lee, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Steve. I have a question about looking at ADD and treating it along with other things. My daughter was diagnosed with it in elementary school, and then in junior high had diagnosis of depression and anxiety disorder.
Right.
And the medication they were giving her for ADD really made her anxiety much, much worse.
Yes.
And we ended up having to pretty much just bail on ADD medication entirely. And I just wondered if there have been any advancements made on how to deal with these things when you're talking about, kind of a triage of things going on.
So there's a connection between ADD meds and anxiety.
Yeah. So Kel, my advanced nurse practitioner, a graduate of the University of Missouri at Kansas City, in fact, is co-authoring the ADD and Zombies book. And we go into extensive detail about exactly what you're describing. So here's the short version. If you think about anxiety as people who care too much, and you think about ADD as people who don't care enough, and I don't mean that like morally. I mean like paying attention to all these little things we need to pay attention to, like the antelope out in Africa or whatever is important. If you don't care enough about those things, that tends to be more ADD. So the problem is the whole point of medications, and this is sort of the layperson's way of looking at this, the whole point of medications for ADD then is to make you care more. Well, if you are somewhat prone to anxiety to begin with, that can very quickly take you over the what we call over the curve, where you have more anxiety than what's productive. So when those coexist, and we go into the detail in the book about how they can coexist, you really want to treat the anxiety first and chase the ADD second, or else you're going to have exactly the outcome that you described.
Hmm. I hope that happened with you, Lee.
Yeah, it actually what she had to do was learn some coping skills for ADD that were non-medication related, and that's what she's been doing for 4 years in high school.
How possible is that, Wes?
What you do with some of that?
Yeah. So
non-medication.
I have two answers to that, and first, let me say we absolutely have several cases like that. And we've just never been able to, no matter what we do, what protocols we use, the stimulants make the person anxious or irritable beyond what we can control for. So we certainly can teach people skills. I have that whole book, I Always Want to Be Where I'm Not, is about that, approaching your life as an ADD person successfully using skills. But the reality is there will always be a limit because ADD is a neurological problem. This is not a theory. This isn't a Dr. Wessism. You can see the brain scans of people with ADD and they differ from the neurotypical folks. So if you can't do it, it's sort of like medicines for diabetes that I can't take. I have to rely on the ones I can take, even though maybe they're not as optimal, and do the other diet and things that I have to do to get around that.
But for folks who aren't crazy about medication, are there non-medication approaches to ADD that get proven successful?
Well, no.
Okay.
So the reality is anybody who will do well on medication for ADD will develop a love-hate relationship with those medicines. I have two kids that are ADD, and you know, one of them's going to law school next year, so we've been pretty successful.
And the love-hate is because
They're not really that fun to be on. I don't know what fool goes in and picks up those medicines to enjoy. Mm-hmm. I don't know anybody that enjoys those medicines that should be on them. So there are side effects like lower appetite, irritability. There's a washout period because the medicine is gone every day at 5 or 6 in the evening out of your system. And these are things that are really unpleasant. So I'm sympathetic to people whose kids or themselves do not like these medicines.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is you can learn all the coping skills in the world, and you still, when it comes to sitting down and learning a list of topics for history class or learning how to operate a machine safely or driving is another possibility, there will be a limit.
Okay. Back to some calls here as we talk about attention deficit disorder with Dr. Wes Crenshaw. Aaron from Overland Park, you're on the air, Aaron.
Hi. As an adult ADHD patient, I appreciate a lot of what Dr. Crenshaw is saying. I was a little taken aback when he was describing, you know, why the hunter theory didn't make any sense, because I think it perpetuates kind of a misconception about those of us with ADHD, which is that we're always sort of frenetic and in a million directions at once, because most of us also have sort of an opposite effect. We have hyperfocus issues. And to me, that hunter lying in the woods because they need to eat is the perfect example of when my hyperfocus kicks in. You know, when you have that one thing that has to be done, and it's almost as dangerous to us as the inattention, because you get so focused in on that one critical has to get done now thing that, you know, the world could be blowing up behind you and you wouldn't notice.
Yeah, that's a real thing, and I didn't mean to construe otherwise. But typically those are things, how we describe this, that are high-value targets, if you will, whether it's school or hunting or whatever it may be happening. And a person can become hyper-focused, but the idea in the hunter myth is, and it is generally not accepted in the literature anymore, the idea is that this is that the hunters were the ADD folks back in the day, they were the ideal hunters. And that just cannot be true. It doesn't mean that there weren't people with ADD who became adapted out of necessity to hunt, which is kind of the point you're saying, that it's value-based, and so they really became able to hyper-focus in that. It's that would not be an optimal style of thinking to become the hunter or the farmer. You got to sit there and wait for the plants to come up. What more boring task could that be? And boredom is a critical element of ADD.
Okay, Aaron, thanks for the call. Sam from Independence, you're on the air, Sam.
Yes, I was going to ask the doctor that since I was a child, I guess I had ADHD, and that's what I had. Like at sixth grade, I had problems with different subjects, especially math. And I think that even if I'm grown up, I still have ADHD because it's very hard for me to concentrate. And I'm also depressed. I take medication for that.
Sam, that's interesting. Can you outgrow it?
Yeah,
or do most people outgrow it?
So Sam brings up two really important issues, and I'll hit them both fast. The first one is that we have gone back and forth throughout my entire career over this idea of whether people outgrow ADD. And at one point, we thought they did. Well, then we began to think, that's just because you leave high school or college and you're not in this high learning environment, so you don't really need to be in the hyper-focus medication, whatever you're doing to cope realm. Well, then there was some research that came back the other direction and said that there is a difference on SPECT scans between people who had ADD when they were teenagers and what they look like now. Not everybody.
You could see a difference.
But some people. Mm-hmm. So the best answer to that question probably is some people may actually have brain development in their 20s before their brain is finished at 25. That kind of militates against the ADD. This may be a thing. We're all very interested in that. But many, many people, if not most, will, as you described, Sam, continue in adulthood with ADD. The second thing he brings up is depression. I just literally wrote that chapter yesterday, very fresh in my mind. And there are kind of two ways to look at this. We don't see depression as what's called comorbid with ADD. It isn't like they just go together. But as I have said to more than one client, and all have agreed, if you have ADD and you're not depressed, you probably don't understand your situation very well, because it is it makes people feel stupid when they're not. It makes people be accused of being lazy when they're not. It makes one feel like they're out of sync and beneath their peer group. This is why self-esteem is lower in people with ADD.
Yeah.
So that's pretty depressing. So sometimes that needs to be treated, and other times, frequently, if the ADD is treated effectively, that sense of depression will go away sometimes.
Trevor from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Trevor.
Hi. Going back to the medication discussion from earlier, when I was younger, I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. I was about 12 or 13, and I was put on what, in hindsight, seems like quite a bit of medication. I was wondering if the doctor could discuss the possible effects of psychoactive medication on developing young minds. It's a little disconcerting for me to see so many kids walking around with prescription drugs when we wouldn't give alcohol or illicit drugs to kids, right? So what is the research on that? Can you speak on that, please?
Well, so that's a whole show of its own. And you actually mentioned bipolar disorder, which is a whole other discussion completely. Now, do the two go together? Sometimes they do, because some people have both. And sometimes people misdiagnose bipolar disorder or misdiagnose ADHD when it's really bipolar disorder, and vice versa. So that's why having a really good relationship with a therapist and prescriber is critically important, because it's not easy, but it's easier to see through some of the complexity of that when you're really having a conversation with somebody. Now, as for medication for ADD, all medications for ADD that are typically used are based on ingredients that go back to the 1950s. They were diet pills in those days, and they began to realize even earlier than that the effect they had on people with hyperkinesis and inattentiveness. So these medicines are old, old, old. I see people, after the book was published, people started rolling in their 50s, who have been on these stimulants since they were, 12 years old, back in the 60s and 70s. So we have a very, very, very unusually long history of seeing the exact same medicines used over my entire lifetime. Now, they've been formulated into different packages, like Vyvanse or Daytrona or Contempla, but they're all based on the same roughly three, but mostly two medications, which are methylphenidate and amphetamines. So we know the answer to that question, and a lot of people have done pretty well. The catch is, and it's critically important, stimulants absolutely build tolerance. This is something that is not discussed enough. So when you build tolerance, the only way to get around that is to have a break periodically, and that's not something people are routinely coached to do.
Okay, we'll have to leave our conversation there. That's Dr. Wes Crenshaw. His forthcoming book, ADD and Zombies, Fearless Medication Management for ADD and ADHD. It'll be out when, Wes?
I hope about August.
Okay. Tomorrow on the show, an architect whose designs focus on creating more resilient cities. You can join us for that conversation. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.